Today's episode is sponsored by AARP. Will Arizona swing blue this election cycle? And what is the role of Hispanic voters over 50? Politico magazine will dial in on this group on July 16th with the latest installment of The Deciders. Visit politico.com/thedeciders to learn more.
Hello, listeners. I'm Scott Bland, your host, and you are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. This week on the show, President Donald Trump is abroad poking and prodding our allies and stoking a trade war, while at home, Vice President Mike Pence deploys to the Midwest to reassure everyone that everything is fine, just fine. Plus, the view from Congress about the hurdles facing Brett Kavanaugh in his confirmation hearing to become the next Associate Justice on the Supreme Court following President Donald Trump's nomination of him earlier this week. A reminder to our listeners to subscribe to the Nerdcast, rate us, and write a review. And stay tuned for the end of the show for a contribution from one of the Nerdcast's biggest fans. One more note before we begin. We are taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday, July 12th, so it's all up to date as of then. Okay, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests, Senior Politics Editor Charlie Mattesian. Good to see you as always.
Hey, Scott.
We've got White House reporter Chris Catalago back with us this week. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good to be back.
And on the line on Skype from Chicagoland, Politico Senior Reporter Natasha Karecki. Hi, Natasha.
Hey, Scott.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
All right, we are going to jump right into our first data point this week. That is the number 2. That stands for 2% of gross domestic product, which is what European NATO members are saying they're eventually going to start spending on defense in the future amidst furious outbursts from President Trump during the NATO meeting with those countries' leaders in Brussels. It's part of a broad, hard line that he's taken with American allies during his latest trip to Europe. We'll dig into all this now. Chris, there are a couple threads we're going to knit together here, and I'll start with you for the first one. So Donald Trump's trip to Europe, he seemed to threaten that the U.S. would go it alone on security at one point today. And, you know, we've seen stuff like this from him during the campaign, but it still seems to shock when he actually comes out and does it in office.
Yeah, it's classic Trump, but he's been saying this for a while now. He said it on the campaign. He went there, ruffled a lot of feathers, and then is leaving, being able to claim some sort of victory because he can say that folks there came around to his view and have made some sort of vague commitment.
And this the details of this commitment, I mean, there aren't very many details, right? It's about a date long in the future about spending a certain amount of gross domestic product on defense spending. But and this is also classic Trump, right? The according to the French president, like, this agreement was already drafted. It had nothing to do with the president's threats and outbursts over the last couple of days.
Yeah, even his demand of moving up from 2% to 4%, that was reiterated from something he had said before he left for this trip. So, he has a playbook that he's going to play from. The folks around him, I think, are fairly happy with them leaving. The question is he doing sort of too much damage to the relationship? And I think even they're aware of that. And their question is, you know, if we're getting what we want from this, but, we're doing it with sort of sharp elbows, are we going to be able to sort of, keep this relationship into the future?
And I think the other thing that's notable about this is that typically presidents have not wanted to link discussion of security pacts with our allies with trade, which is something that Trump has shown no problems with doing. And Natasha, you've been reporting on the effects of the president's trade policies in the Midwest this week. And, you know, it was earlier this week we saw the administration stoke more fears about a trade war by publishing a new list of about $200 billion worth of tariffs on Chinese goods that could go into effect this summer. And meanwhile, now we see Vice President Mike Pence heading out to the Midwest to try and kind of calm fears about this. Right, Natasha?
Yeah, that's right. Pence is on a Midwest damage control tour. He stopped in Kansas City and Iowa, and then on Friday he'll be in Chicago area. And these are all states that are seeing the greatest impact from Trump's tariff war. And these are, at least especially in Iowa, that's feeling the greatest impact. But it's also a state that swung for Trump. And they know they have to go back they have to go back to the base, reassure the base, kind of remind them of the things that Trump's done for them, the tax cuts, standing up to China, talk about trusting Trump, and that it's all going to be better in the long run.
Can you talk us through some of the specifics about how people are feeling the effects of what's going on trade? I think like the way we talk about it sometimes is very abstract. It's very kind of 30,000 foot. But like the some of the agricultural products, some of the manufacturing products. I mean, the people are already feeling changes at their companies, on their farms, things like that.
Right. I mean, we're seeing companies laying people off, companies threatening to leave. There's all kinds of estimates. Iowa says it could lose $1 billion in soybean and pork alone. You have the agricultural sector just kind of begging for mercy right now. Uncertainty in the markets. So you have all of that happening. But what I'm really hearing from some of the farmers and some of the industry leaders is that there's a short-term impact now. Profits are plummeting and so forth. But what they're really worried about is the long-term impact and the relationship with China. You know, this is something that a lot of them say they've built up over decades of going to China, sort of being this, we are the American farmer. You can count on us no matter what. And now that's the relationship that's being damaged. And they're also seeing investment from China in South America and elsewhere, which is really terrifying them because it's not an indication that China's going to fold. It's that they're taking their business elsewhere.
That's really interesting. I wonder, you talk about this long-term relationship. I've been wondering for a few weeks now, about Terry Branstad and kind of what he's thinking and doing about all this, right? This is the multi-decade mm-hmm. former governor of Iowa who, on the back of some of those relationships that you just talked about, became President Trump's ambassador to China. Haven't really seen much of him in the news lately, but I just wonder, he's got to be hearing it from all sides, right? Obviously, he communicates closely with the Chinese government, but he built his political career off of these relationships with Iowa farmers, the soybean growers, the corn growers, folks who are really feeling a lot of this, and those industry groups who have a lot of pull in Iowa politics. And it's crazy to me to think about him now caught in the middle of a trade war, based on this stuff, right, Charlie? I mean, we think about Iowa a lot, and as people covering politics, it's like this is like bedrock stuff for someone like Branstad.
Yeah,
and now Frang.
And I think Branstad occupies a really unique position in the Iowa political world. I mean, if there was a Mount Rushmore in Iowa, he'd probably end up on it. I mean, he has been governor of Iowa, almost nonstop since the 1980s. I mean, there are probably lots of people in Iowa that don't even know any other governor other than him. And so he has, I think, a certain cachet, and he validated, I think, the Trump administration's positions. I think Iowa might be freaking out more if such a stalwart wasn't leading the policy and vouching for it in the home state. And so, yeah, I think he's a big player on this. And what's really interesting, though, is that Iowa was slow to freak out. Natasha wrote about this a couple weeks ago. She wrote a great story. And I don't want to steal your thunder, Natasha, so feel free to step all over me if I'm mischaracterizing your story. But, I mean, she wrote a great story. She spent some time in Iowa and found that people were willing to give the administration a little rope, a little time on this. But now you can see there's much more widespread sign of panic, not just in Iowa, but across the Midwest, where they're really beginning to acutely feel the pressure here. And what's really important about this is, if you take a look at the damage control tour, Pence damage control tour, he's going to Iowa and Illinois, and you're talking about just those two states alone, given the competitive races that are, battleground districts in those places, those two states alone get you a quarter of the way to a House majority. If Democrats pick up all of the really competitive seats in those two states alone, they get a quarter of the way to winning back the House.
That's a really good point.
If I could add one thing about Branstad, I mean, I think that's sort of why we saw the slow panic, because there's people like that who have longstanding relationships with, the Iowa Soybean Association and all these other different association agricultural sector who are meeting with him. They can pick up the phone and talk to him immediately. They have really strong relationships, and he is reassuring them. And he's also telling them that it's not going to end anytime soon, that this is something Trump really, truly believes in, and they're in for the long haul, which is, that's really what's terrifying them.
So, the Chris, on the one hand, you've got folks like Branstad and now Pence going on what Natasha calls this damage control tour, right, as Trump kind of like roams through Europe with a hammer, basically, like looking for glass to break, it seems like. And you had a line this week in your story about how the president and vice president are like two hands on a clock. They're always in motion, but crossing only seldom. And this is a strategy for the White House, right? This is not coincidence.
This has been a strategy for them. What I would say from the Trump side of the concerns that we're also not only hearing in the Midwest, but we're hearing more and more from folks on the Hill. We had a quote in the story this week that probably would not have emerged a couple weeks ago about how people are getting more and more nervous about this, and they're worried that it'll just wipe away the tax cut message that they'd been leaning on. From the Trump perspective, I this is not going to stop, and I think part of the reason is you talk to the folks around him, and this polls really, really well for him. It continues to poll well.
When you say this, you mean the kind of the tough talk?
The idea that he's talking tough on tariffs, whether it's okay. China, whether it's the EU, whether it's Canada. They feel like what's registering in these polls is that finally folks have someone who is fighting for them. You know, they go back to the first George W. Bush run and when he sort of touched on some of these messages. I mean, these are long-standing themes that they think are winners. And until it starts to harm President Trump politically, it's not going to stop.
Interesting. I mean, but, you know, we're seeing some evidence here that it could end up harming him politically. Right? It all depends on whether some of these trade disputes get resolved in a way that prevents some or all the tariffs from actually going into effect, whether some of the price shifts that we've seen already continue or multiply, or if they kind of recede, right? There's all sorts of moving parts here.
Trump's made a bunch of big bets that will, you know, that he needs to cash in on. These things are not going to go on forever. He made a huge bet with North Korea. He made a huge bet on these tariffs. He's making a huge bet with NATO. So all these things could come back to haunt him. I'm not saying that there's not a considerable risk to each of these things, but the idea that he's going to back down now is unlikely to happen. And the folks around him continue to say that this is something that will bring China to the table, for instance. I mean, they still feel like that's going to happen. Someone told us yesterday that that's going to happen even before the midterm. So they feel really good about it. And we'll just have to see what happens.
Interesting. That's a very big bet.
And keep in mind that the trade war pain that we've seen so far, and you know, for the near term, has been disproportionately allocated throughout Trump country. I mean, you're talking about the heavy manufacturing states that he won, Indiana, places like that. But you're also talking about Iowa, Missouri. So soybeans in Missouri and Iowa, pork in Iowa, North Carolina, Minnesota, not a state that he won, but a state where he came close. So this is all right in his sweet spot and right in all the areas he's going to need to run strongly and if he has any hope of winning re-election in 2020.
That's a really good point. Natasha, what are you kind of picking up on that so far? I mean, like we said, it's the, you know, it seems like so far people are kind of willing to let this play out a little bit more. Obviously, you know, we're less than 4 months from the midterms at this point, but we've got still a ways to go until 2020 that Charlie just mentioned. But you know, do you have a sense of what happens next, basically?
just seeing Pence being dispatched to these different states is a sign, really the first sign we've seen that the administration's putting forth any kind of organized damage control strategy. So there's something happening here because he's going through, he's trying to message in these states, and it's right after we saw one tariff put on Friday, then we had retaliatory tariffs, and then we had some more threatened earlier this week. So, I mean, I think that in and of itself is an indication that they're getting jittery. And you also see people like Chuck Grassley, who yesterday in Iowa, he was saying, hey, I've been at 10 different town hall meetings and all I'm hearing about is trade. So I think you have elected officials who just a few weeks ago were encouraging people to be patient and have trust in Trump are now really turning up the heat because people are turning up the heat on them. I mean, there's some farmers I talk to who say, well, you know, we're okay for this season because we've already allocated most of the stuff. We've priced it out. It's not really going to hit us until next year. But it's 2019 that especially the industry leaders are really skittish about. They said that's going to come down hard then. And one thing I asked everyone I talked to was, you know, if Pence comes through, what do you want to hear him say? And they all said the same thing, which is he's going to say this is going to end. So they're waiting for this to end like any day now. And I think as if it keeps dragging out, which it appears it's going to, it's going to get just worse politically for Trump.
Interesting. All right. Well, that sounds like a long tail that we're going to have to keep an eye on all this. But fortunately, you'll be there watching it for us, right, Natasha?
That's right.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for jumping on Skype to join us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Chris and Charlie, I know you guys are sticking around for the next segment. Let's take a quick break before we jump into that, though, for a word from a sponsor. 5, 6, 7, 8.
Today's episode is sponsored by AARP. Voters over 50 are poised to decide the 2018 midterms. In partnership with AARP, Politico Magazine's new Decider series is using original polling, data analysis, and cutting-edge data visualization tools to explore this age group. This month, Politico Magazine will explore Hispanic voters over 50 in Arizona and investigate which forces are likely to influence the 2018 midterms. Will it be voter turnout in this group or identity politics that's the deciding factor? Visit politico.com/thedeciders on July 16th to learn more.
All right, let's move on to our next data point, which is four. There are four hurdles facing Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh in his Senate confirmation hearing, according to the reporting of our next guest, Burgess Everett, who covers the Senate for Politico. Hi, Burgess. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. So let's run through each of these four hurdles one by one, if we can, maybe lightning round style. I'll say the hurdle. You can say how high it is and how far Brett Kavanaugh is going to have to jump and for whom. So healthcare, that's the big one that was kind of right up top and one that a lot of Democrats are talking about, right?
Yeah, I mean, you've seen sort of, and we can get into this a little bit later, but the Democratic leadership kind of started off with a few different messages. They said, let's delay this confirmation, let's make it about abortion. No, actually, let's make it about healthcare. And I think that's the one that resonates the most in the Democratic caucus. Everyone in the caucus opposed repealing Obamacare. And so they are all on the same page about preserving protections for people with pre-existing conditions. And there's a lawsuit that's been launched by Republican attorneys general, and it may come before the Supreme Court and strike down parts of Obamacare. So even someone like Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who everyone thinks is the most likely Democrat to vote for Kavanaugh, has sort of given himself an escape hatch if he hears something he doesn't like on pre-existing conditions.
Right. And West Virginia being one of those states where Medicaid expansion has been a huge, huge issue in recent races. Let's dig into a little bit. You mentioned abortion kind of like as a subset of healthcare here, but one that's generating a lot of attention with regard to Kavanaugh and the potential realignment on the Supreme Court, right? And now,
yeah,
healthcare being an issue where Democrats are obviously united, but abortion being one where some Democrats think they might be able to pick off a Republican or two.
Yeah, and so like Manchin and Joe Donnelly of Indiana, they're both up for re-election and they're both anti-abortion. That's their position. So this is not a position that unifies the Democrats. So on the Republican side, it might be a little bit more resonant because there are two moderates, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who typically support abortion rights. And so, you know, they're kind of in a tough spot on exactly what to do on this nomination, because it could, you know, shift the balance of the court, and that could end up with Roe v. Wade being overturned, and, you know, they would probably be to blame for that if that would happen. So they kind of need to go into this thinking, well, is he going to give us some reassurance that this isn't going to happen? And if it is a reassurance, it's not going to be explicit. It will be some sort of wink or some sort of gut feeling they have about him. But that's sort of the best way that Democrats think you could get those two Republicans to vote no.
What's your current read, Burgess, on what they are thinking and how they're positioning themselves? I just saw there's another story out just this morning about comments that Kavanaugh had made in the last year about Roe versus Wade being kind of basically the way he phrased it was not something he approved of.
Right. And my feeling is those two are going to be yes votes unless there is a bombshell in his record. I would not call that a bombshell in his record because they can just say that's a speech. That's not a ruling. He did rule on this immigrant who was seeking an abortion, and they were in government custody last year, and he's gotten flack. He opposed letting this person have access to an abortion, so he's got flack from conservatives for not, you know, being hardline enough on this opinion, but also liberals for stepping in and denying abortion access. But other than that, you know, I'm not sure that there's anything in his record that's going to explicitly tell them how he's going to rule. And I just knowing those two senators fairly well personally, I can't imagine a speech is going to be something that drives their vote on this.
Interesting. All right. So hurdle one was health care. Hurdle two was abortion. The next one that you mentioned in your story was surveillance policy. Talk us through that.
Well, if you know Rand Paul, you know he's got a flair for the dramatic. And I think at some point he will make a big stink about Kavanaugh's sort of approval of the metadata programs that were exposed a few years ago by Edward Snowden. I don't know if it's going to be enough to get Rand Paul to vote no, but he generally knows when to make sort of his charge in the public domain about these nominees. He voted against CIA Director Gina Haspel. He voted for Secretary of State Mike Pompeo after saying he would do everything he could to oppose him. So, you know, you kind of have to take anything he says with a little bit of grain of salt, but he's voted against more Trump nominees than any other Republican. So, you know, I would guess that is like his main concern with Kavanaugh and will probably become a big story at some point. I am told he's very worried about this, but he is not saying so publicly.
Do Paul and other civil liberties advocates, do their worries about surveillance stem more from Kavanaugh's record as a judge on the D.C. appeals court or from his record as a kind of staff attorney in the Bush White House?
He wrote an opinion on the metadata program sort of saying that national security trumps privacy in this instance. And so you do have him on the record on this. And I think that would be more sort of concerning to someone like Rand Paul.
Gotcha. Okay, so we've gone through three topics so far. The fourth one is seems to come up in just about everything these days. It's the Mueller investigation, and you wrote about how that could potentially play into the Supreme Court hearings as well.
Yeah, and whether anything from the Mueller investigation comes before the Supreme Court, and obviously Kavanaugh has been ridiculed by Democrats for sort of asserting that, you know, presidential power people shouldn't necessarily be able to file lawsuits against a sitting president and sort of get into their personal liabilities. He wants Congress to pass a law for that, but I think it's enough of an opening for Democrats to talk about Mueller. I think, you know, the problem is I don't know that that's going to be enough to change anybody's mind in terms of how they're going to vote on this nomination unless there is some major movement with the special counsel. And I also think another issue is you're just talking about so many issues with this guy now. The messaging is not, like, super simple, and that's usually sort of what drives at least, you know, the debate in the public domain.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the other issue is that, and we've talked about this a number of times before, but it bears repeating. There's just a simple structural disadvantage here for Democrats, right? Of course, they want to defeat this nominee, but they Republicans have functionally a 50-49 majority. They have 51 seats, but John McCain who's suffering from brain cancer, has not voted in a while.
Right.
And, you know, so they don't have a majority. And meanwhile, there are a handful of senators who voted to confirm Justice Neil Gorsuch, right, could potentially be in play. Now, who are those?
That's Donnelly of Indiana, Manchin of West Virginia, and Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota. And you also got Doug Jones of Alabama in play. He was not in the Senate when Gorsuch was confirmed. you also have to kind of flash back to, like, this fight on Gorsuch, and there used to be a 60-vote threshold on Supreme Court nominees. Democrats filibustered Gorsuch. McConnell changed the rules. There was a thought in the party at the time, hey, maybe let's save our ammunition for the next nominee, because you're really just replacing Scalia with Gorsuch, a conservative for a conservative. Now you're replacing Kennedy, you know, a so-called moderate or swing vote, with somebody who's certainly more conservative. So there is a little bit of, like, buyer's remorse among Democrats for choosing that fight then, and then flashing back even further to the initial rules change on lower court nominees and cabinet secretaries went from 60 to 50 in 2013. So, you know, there's definitely a sense of, like, man, maybe we really kind of screwed up the strategy on this.
Charlie, I'm curious what you think about this, though, in terms of the political cross pressures for these Democrats in these red states who, you know, obviously face, no matter how red the state, you still have a Democratic base, right? Who's going to be pushing them on this? A lot of their donor base is going to be pushing them on this. You know, Claire McCaskill raises a lot of money online from all over the country, for example. On the flip side, Republicans are arguing that to vote against a conservative Supreme Court justice would be a killer in a state as red as Missouri or Montana or West Virginia or what have you.
Yeah, I think the Democratic base is, in many respects, just sort of denying reality. I think leadership is trying to explain to them the way it works and that there are limits to what they can do. And I don't think the Democratic base wants to hear it. And it could end up being a huge tactical mistake that these members make, largely because the base will not hear of anything. They don't care about anything. They just want resistance. And, you know, when you take a look at the political math and the political logic of these votes, I mean, these red staters, why would you ever die on this hill when you can't do anything about it ultimately? So I think, you know, in the end, I think we see the three that went for Gorsuch voting the same way again. And I also think that if you're the other red staters, if you're a tester or if you are Claire McCaskill, right now you're in for a dime, so you got to go in for a dollar. You don't gain anything by casting a vote for Kavanaugh. I suspect, you know, if they're smart, they will just stay with it. They've already lodged a vote against the Trump administration, so you might as well stick with it. And I think, you know, if you're somebody like Claire McCaskill, you have to think of the calculus. And I think she's already done this, the same one that you used for Neil Gorsuch, which was, if you're in Missouri, what you need to win that seat, to win re-election, is to have a robust turnout and to win St. Louis and Kansas City, the two Democratic bulwarks. And then you kind of, you know, see if maybe you're lucky enough to keep it in check in the rest of the state. Well, the way to do that is the way to really ramp up turnout in the two big Democratic strongholds is to vote against Kavanaugh. So I think that's the way she sticks there. But I mean, I don't think you're going to see anything dramatically different than what we've seen. I don't with the votes for Kavanaugh. I think the same calculus that applied for Gorsuch is going to apply here.
I can raise one wild card to me, Charlie, is Bill Nelson, who's in a lot more trouble than he was a year and a half ago politically. I don't know that he's a no vote, but, you know, he's the person whose circumstances changed the most that's on the map right now.
That's really interesting, Burgess. Do you think that he might come out for Kavanaugh?
I don't, but I just feel like if you are Bill Nelson and you feel like this is trending away from you, Rick Scott's raising $10 million, the polls are starting to show you down, you're getting beat up for Hispanic support, a no vote could be one way to change the trajectory of your, I mean, a yes vote could be one way to change the trajectory of your campaign.
I was going to say, you can almost already hear the justification for going back to Charlie's point of the three that voted for Gorsuch, which is, you know, we oppose Trump on these big policies, tax reform, some of these others, but we come out and we let him have some of his nominees. And you see that in the cabinet, too.
Mm-hmm. So it's discretion kind of the office.
Yeah, it's kind of this established position that they've taken, and it doesn't break from what they've done in the past.
That's a really good point. Hey, Chris, before we let you go, I wanted to touch a little bit on the relationship between the president and his nominee, which you and some of our colleagues did some really good reporting on this last week. You and Nancy Cook and Andrew Restuccia wrote about how Trump seems really taken by Kavanaugh and how Anthony Kennedy helped get him there.
Yeah, it was one of those situations where Trump basically ended up where he started. This was the early favorite, Kavanaugh, and I think he wanted to be assured by the White House counsel and folks around him that this was going to be a good pick. They were taking a lot of time going and pouring through archives for a number of these reasons, whether it's the his work on the Starr investigation or, the 300-plus decisions. And so I think it was a question of due diligence, but they did hit it off from what we heard. A lot of people very close to Trump who you may not expect were weighing in on behalf of Kavanaugh, in addition to White House counsel Don McGahn. So he was hearing from a lot of people. At the same time, you had meetings with some of the other contenders, including Amy Comey Barrett, that may not have gone as well. We heard very soon after that that Trump was thinking, folks around him are already thinking, whether it's the Ruth Bader Ginsburg seat, and even some of them who are really bullish, the Sotomayor one, they seem to think that could open up. This is, what their sort of internal talk, that she might be perfect for that one. So the lines were kind of drawn early, and the other thing was he wanted to sort of stoke excitement and interest in this pick. So it was kind of in his interest to go out and continue to sort of poll people and ask them who they thought, even though our reporting showed that he basically come to this decision late the week before on Friday and was just sort of going through the weekend and talking it out with folks at Bedminster.
Interesting. Burgess, I want to give you the last word here. From your perch on the Hill, what's the next steps and the progression of this that we should be looking out for? Kavanaugh is obviously probably going to be meeting with a ton of senators one-on-one over the next few weeks, right? And where does it go from there?
I mean, I guess what I would probably be looking for is something sort of newsy and juicy out of these one-on-one meetings. And what I point to with regards to that is when Gorsuch was doing these, he met with several Democrats and said, basically this was sort of engineered by his Sherpa, Kelly Ayotte, and the White House, but they were saying, tell these senators that you're uncomfortable with Trump's attacks on the judiciary. And he did that, and eventually Senator Blumenthal came out and said it in front of the cameras. And so that sort of created this sort of, I don't know, what the White House was looking for is this sort of little bit of independence from Trump. And so I wonder if you'll see something like that from Kavanaugh over the next few weeks. The other thing to watch is probably when they schedule a hearing. Kavanaugh has 300 cases he's ruled on. He's made a bunch of speeches. He's also got hundreds of thousands of pages of documents with his name on it from when he was in the White House. So how long does it take for Chuck Grassley and Dianne Feinstein to get a deal on what they're going to go through, and how long does it take them to get it all together? The Senate has canceled most of its August recess, so are they going to have a hearing, in August or September? There could be a big difference in terms of how quickly they would do the confirmation. McConnell wants to get this done by October 1st. I think that'll be tough, but it is doable right now unless there's a big hiccup in this document production.
Got it. Okay, Burgess, thank you so much for taking us through all that. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Of course, thanks.
And Chris, thank you so much for joining us again this week.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Charlie, thank you as always.
Thanks, Scott.
Okay, as promised, before we say goodbye to all of you, this week we're going to turn things over briefly to one Nerdcast superfan for the credits. James Folta of New York's 12th Congressional District. Pop quiz, Charlie. Which one's that?
Oh, that's the Perfume Stockade. Come on, that's Carolyn Maloney's Upper East Side, Manhattan, and a little bit of Astoria, and I think a little bit of Brooklyn.
James Folta is going to help us out with the credits this week. James, take it away.
Nerdcast is produced by Michaela Rodriguez, with help from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer, and their illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you very much, James. Listeners, we found James because he emailed in to say he was a fan. If you are a fan of the Nerdcast who wants to read the credits and tell us your congressional district and have Charlie identify esoteric facts about it on air, let us know. Shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We will talk to you again next week.